Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app.
Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card.
Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. Everybody needs some variety in life. That's what I love about Chumba Casino. They know how to keep things fresh and exciting. All their games are free to play, like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire. You can claim free daily login bonuses, too. And they release new games every week. So spice things up with ChumbaCasino.com now for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And you would have thought with that Beyonce endorsement, they would have just gone sky high.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
I want to take the future. I want to win. And you don't get there by being some aw shucks, nice guy sap.
There's no place in business for people like that.
Business is war. It's dog eat dog, rat eat rat. If my competitor were drowning, I'd walk over and I'd put a hose right in his mouth.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 144 of Wreckatopia. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho to all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bunnerinos. Wow,
just like the chat was doing, just like the chat was saying. And also joining us is Jeremy Scott.
Hello!
There you go. There we go. We're getting off to the right start this morning.
That was my Uncle Leo impression.
Hello! Hello! Jerry, hello! And we would like to welcome chat who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you for coming out today. Aaron, do you have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Sure, I can do that. Again, I've been watching a lot of stuff, but I wanted to touch base on a movie that I finally got a chance to see and recommend it, even though not many people are technically recommending it. Although somebody on this very show recommended the graphic novel it is based on.
Oh, you son of a bitch.
I saw the movie here and I really liked it. Like, really, really liked it. And I know that's not the, my understanding is that's not the common experience with this movie. From what I can tell, it just got me. It just really resonated with me. There's something, if you don't know the concept, Jeremy talked about it a little bit when he recommended the graphic novel, but we're in a time and space that doesn't, well, we're in a space that doesn't change as time changes around it. And it jumps back and forth through, you know, the history of time, but primarily focuses on the living room of a house that is built across from a home that I guess was owned by Benjamin Franklin's son in Philadelphia. And we get to know this family through the different bits and pieces and jumping around in time. We get to know a couple different families that have lived there. There's also a tale of Native American population that lived in the area and some things going on there. I found it incredibly moving to be locked off in space and just watch voyeuristically, if you will, what is happening in this space. There's something about being removed from all elements of being proactive in a story. Like, you don't realize how camera movements cut, different environments, those kind of things change your perspective on your ability to see things. But when you're locked off, there's something about it that just makes you a complete observer. And something about that, for me, gave me the expanse of humanity. So you're watching, you know, trauma and love and the good times and the bad times and the mediocre times. And, you know, I found it incredibly moving on a just on an expanse kind of level. It's hard to explain. I felt the hugeness of humanity and the tininess of humanity at the same time through the way this was presented. So I loved it. I really had a good time with it. So I thought I'd give it a shout out as a recommend.
I'm not going to take that from you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm probably not going to watch this movie anytime in the next decade, but the critics don't like it very much, but the fans are 59%. So I think you've got a lot of support. And you've obviously got James in the chat who's very, very glad to hear what you're saying. So it's fine.
It's good not to be alone, James. Good not to be alone.
You're going
to
hear a lot from me when we get to the big recommend. So, Chris, if you're cool, I'll slide in here for my small recommend.
I was going to get to you.
Sorry, I should have let you do it. It's only like my fourth show back. Give me a break. So my small recommend this week is a movie called Res Ball. It's on Netflix. This is from one of the creators of, let's see, I'm going to get it wrong, Reservation
Dogs?
Yeah. The TV show. Yep. My wife watched it. It's got critical acclaim. A lot of people love it.
I've watched all of it. It's great. It's worth a watch. Yeah, excellent. Definitely.
I don't think there's as much comedy in this movie as there is in the show.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you about the first 20 minutes of this movie. Both because I want to warn some people who may have triggers, but also I think it might help hook you. This is about a high school basketball team in New Mexico on a reservation, and their star player has lost his mom and sister, I believe, to a drunk driver in recent months. And so he's devastated, but everybody is excited about the season because he's an amazing player. He's clearly not right. And within the first 20 minutes, he takes his own life. That does not happen on camera. But I know that that can still be triggering for some people. And then the movie abruptly and almost shockingly shifts to his best friend, Jimmy, who is now the best player on the team and has to lead what looks like a pretty mediocre team through the season. But they come up with this basic hyper-hustle style of play, and they start calling out their plays in Navajo so that the other teams won't know the plays that they're calling. And from there, I'll let you enjoy the ride. I had a really good time with this. My wife and I watched it together, and if you like feel-good sports movies, you may not be surprised by all the beats here, but it hits the beats correctly, and I enjoyed it.
Excellent. I have not heard of this at all. So, yeah. So you say it's connected to another show or another?
It's not connected. It's just this one of the creators of Reservation Dogs.
Oh, okay.
Wrote this movie.
For some reason, Reservation Dogs, Res Ball. I thought that was some sort of offshoot there.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they titled it that on purpose. But there is not, to my knowledge, any direct correlation between the show and the film.
No, okay.
Yeah.
And this is based on a true story, like Hollywood does.
Right, exactly. I am going to do a recommend. I know I've done before in the Sincast days. I've also done its remake, I think, split between both of these podcasts. But sometimes you watch a bunch of movies that you've already seen before and you don't have room for one of those movies that you saw, like a brand new movie that you're like, hey, guys, go see this. But I'm going to re-recommend, if you guys remember back in the Sincast days, The Wages of Fear from 1953. This movie takes place, I believe, in Puerto Rico. Don't quote me on that. I don't remember hearing the place, but... it takes place in a town where there is a lot of like people looking for work, a lot of people who want to get out but can't because they don't have money or visa or anything like that. And so they are constantly looking for something that will help them survive in this town. And we get sort of a slice of life. The slice of life takes a while. It builds up to where we're going on here. It takes a good, I want to say 40 minutes to an hour before we get to an actual, like our actual action of this story. But the main crux of this is that there is a oil company in town, and they basically, they're an American oil company, and so of course you can take all the connotations you want to with all this and everything. But one of their oil derricks gets set on fire or blows up or something like that 300 miles away. And they need some truckers to go and take nitroglycerin to the oil derricks to blow them up and stop the fire, basically. So they have to go through sort of a tryout type of thing and get four of the best so that they can take turns on this long trip, driving very slowly, but also sometimes having to drive very fast with tons of nitroglycerin in the back of their truck, where any slightest jump can cause an explosion. And so when the movie starts onto that tact, you're going down, these guys are going down the road. Of course, they have conversations during it, but during this whole time, they keep running into these challenges of trying to go through a mountainous terrain, a forested terrain with nitroglycerin in the back. And, and how they solve these problems and everything is great. Any of these guys could die at any moment, at any time in this movie. That's what's so insane about it. The Wages of Fear is a fantastic movie that, if you haven't been compelled to see it from me already, I'm going to give you another chance here. You got to go see The Wages of Fear. And if you don't want to see The Wages of Fear, watch the William Friedkin remake, Sorcerer, which is also freaking amazing. So
when you were just describing this, I was like, boy, this sounds a lot like that Sorcerer movie he talks about a lot. And I didn't realize that was a remake of this. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the Friedkin version gets into it faster. It doesn't sit there and give you the life story of a lot of these people before going into it. Sorcerer is like, zoom. Okay, there's three people in one place. Let's go and make them truck drivers. Almost. It's not that fast, but it's really, they do it out of desperation and everything. And then the Sorcerer is just as intense when it gets to that point. So anyway, go watch The Wages of Fear, you animals.
Animals.
That's right. All right. Let's go on to our big recommend, which is The Founder, and it's Jeremy's pick. So, Jeremy, take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The Founder, based on a true story, The Founder opens with Ray Kroc, who is Batman, selling the viewer on a Prince Castle 5-spindle milkshake mixer and why it's superior to a single spindle. You increase the supply, demand will follow, he wrongly says repeatedly. In the end, it turns out he was actually selling a restaurant owner, and he fails to make the sale. It's the 1950s, and we see that Ray is annoyed to have to wait so long for his lunch at the drive-in after failing to make the sale. We get another failed sale at another restaurant, and another instance of Ray being annoyed that the drive-in gets his order wrong. He calls his wife, who is paleobotanist Dr. Ellie Sadler, from the hotel, who doesn't sound like she believes him that there is a ton of interest in the multi-mixer. Then pours a drink and listens to a record called The Power of the Positive, which is fictional, by the way, though it's largely lifted from a real record. The next day, he has another failed sale at a barbecue drive-in and does some day drinking. We'll learn later on that Ray Kroc is the kind of guy who keeps going from get-rich-quick idea to get-rich-quick idea, and the milkshake mixer is just the latest in a long line of the next big thing. Checking in with the office, he learns that a drive-in from California has ordered 6 multi-mixers. Certain it's wrong, so he calls the place himself and speaks with Dick McDonald, who is Ron Swanson, and learns that the drive-in actually wants 8 mixers now. And Ray Kroc simply has to see this place for himself. So he drives halfway across the country to California. He stands in a very long line, but is impressed how quickly it moves. And in one of my favorite scenes in the movie, Ray walks up to the counter and converses with the cheeriest McDonald's employee who ever existed. Ray does not believe the food handed to him is his because it comes out too fast. And when he asks where the silverware is, this guy goes, "You just eat it straight out of the wrapper, and then you throw it all away." While he's eating, he's asked if everything was okay by Mac McDonald, the other owner, who is the Zodiac Killer. And once he introduces himself as the multi-mixer guy, he gets a tour of the restaurant's operation, where he learns how they get the food out so quickly. The tour is interrupted, though, when Dick informs Mac that the fries are 5% too crisp. Croc then invites the brothers out for dinner so he can hear their story. This is my actual favorite scene in the whole movie, when Dick and Mac tell their story to Ray and get so caught up in it, they start playing themselves as though they're putting on a play. It's delightful. They started driving trucks for Columbia Pictures before buying their own movie theater right before the stock market crash of 1929. Eventually, they see that the only person making money in town is the hot dog stand owner. So they blatantly steal his idea and make their own hot dog stand. The blatant theft may become important later. There aren't enough people in town to support two hot dog stands. So they saw their building in half so it will fit under the bridge on the road to San Bernardino and relocate there. After finding initial success, sales fall off, and Dick realizes 87% of their sales are in just three items: burgers, fries, and soft drinks. Realizing their whole lives they have piggybacked on other people's ideas, they set out to distinguish their hamburger stand through speed of service, and they invent the Speedy system. I enjoy this part, too, where they go to the tennis court. We get to see them drawing with the chalk and for hours and hours. When they reopen, customers aren't understanding the lack of car hops and the walk-up window. So they do a big grand reopening, but it's ruined by a plague of flies. Mm-hmm. But the next day, customers show up for some reason, and the place is successful overnight. Back in the present, Ray shows up the next morning yelling franchise, trying to convince the brothers to franchise the restaurant, but they have already done it, and it didn't go well because it's hard to enforce quality control from afar. I mean, San Francisco was selling burritos. But Ray is undeterred. He sees a concept art on the wall of the Golden Arches and is told that the idea is some pure Dick magic. I'm sorry, I just had to get that phrase.
Yep.
Ray drives to Phoenix to look at the Golden Arches. He's mesmerized, and also they apparently leave the Golden Arches on all night.
Mm-hmm.
Returning home, he tells his wife about McDonald's, and she reminds him that he has always chased new ideas and that she is lonely. She says he doesn't support her. Wait, he says she doesn't support him, when it's clear she always has, as she reminds him. He goes to the movies to see On the Waterfront, which lost the Best Picture race to Marty, and drinks some more. He tries going back out on the multi-mixer sales route, but finds himself just unable to do it. So he goes back to McDonald's and tells them to franchise again. But this time, they should do it for their country. And somehow this pitch works. Apparently, this has always been Dick's dream. Mac talks Dick into doing it, and they sign some documents. Ray immediately goes to the bank for a loan and takes credit for the Golden Arches himself. He gets rejected for two loans and ends up taking out a second mortgage on his house to fund his first McDonald's, and he doesn't tell his wife about it. Seeds of conflict with the McDonald's brothers begin immediately, as they take a long time to review changes he made to building plans to add a basement, among other things. Ray hangs up on Dick. Next, they argue about a Coke sponsorship on Ray's menu boards, and he again hangs up on Dick. Once Ray's first franchise opens, we see his meticulous attention to detail, insisting on every aspect of the Speedy system and its operation, including hat placement, be perfect. And we see that he also keeps his Golden Arches turned on all night, which is kind of weird. But to make up for neglecting his wife, Ray takes her to dinner at the club. But when Ray turns the dinner into a sales pitch for their club friends, his wife is justifiably upset, but chooses to swallow her anger and support her husband by joining the pitch. We then get a montage of Ray ignoring his wife to sell franchises to his golf buddies. He sells a lot. Back in California, Dick is upset to learn that Ray has opened so many franchises so quickly, but Mac doesn't see the problem. Ray visits one of the franchises he sold to a friend and finds them serving chicken and biscuits and not keeping their location clean, and he loses it when he sees lettuce on a burger. He runs out onto the golf course to confront the franchisee about the lettuce. Ray is so mad, he quits the club. We next see Ray take a Bible salesman in his office and sell him a franchise, helping us to see that Ray is interested in selling franchises more than anything else. The Bible guy actually turns out to be one of the better franchise owners, and Ray realizes it's because he and his wife are teaming up together. Next, Ray takes his wife to eat at the VFW bingo night, where it continues to be clear that all Ray wants to do is network and sell franchises. He starts targeting married couples because he believes they'll buy in together, and we get a montage of him selling McDonald's to various groups as a pro-family business. From here, the franchises increase exponentially. At this point, we meet Raleigh Smith, who is Night Owl, and who owns a fine dining spot where Ray and his latest franchisee are dining. Raleigh knows about Ray's empire and is impressed. This is also where we learn that Ray has promoted Fred Turner to his associate, largely because he mastered grilling a burger very quickly. While being wooed by Night Owl, who is also ghost hunter Ed Warren, Ray is distracted by a beautiful piano player who is Velma. Night Owl rolls with it and sets up a meeting between Ray and the woman, who then he introduces as his wife, absolutely harshing Ray's boner. Ray drinks too much and then claims to have started McDonald's in 1954. Velma goes back to the piano and plays Ray's favorite song, Pennies from Heaven, which he joins her for. Ray realizes he's losing money and calls the brothers to renegotiate his percentage. Dick refuses, and then Mac guilt trips Dick, trying to get him to change his mind. At home, Ray's wife, who is Citizen Ruth, confronts him about the second mortgage. Ray's response to this is to go to the bank and yell at the person who told his wife about the second mortgage. He responds by going to visit Velma at her franchise to try and sell her another. There, he learns that she has discovered powdered milkshakes instead of real ice cream ones. It would save tons of space, electricity, and money. He calls up the brothers to try to sell them on it, but they resist. In a twist, Dick hangs up on Ray after saying it's called a milkshake, Ray, now and forever. But Ray is still facing final notices from creditors. We see him pleading in the bank for an extension, and he is eavesdropped on by BJ Novak. Who is BJ Novak? Novak is playing Harry Sonnenborn, and he follows Kroc out of the bank to tell him that if you're not making money hand over fist, there's a problem. He returns to Ray's office and examines his books. And he's going to change Ray's world by explaining to Ray how real estate works. And something tells me this character isn't a real person. He is. What was put in the script to help us, the viewers, understand Ray's shift into owning all the land his franchises operate on, which is how McDonald's becomes a real estate empire rather than a fast food empire. And it is no coincidence that Novak's pitch ends the same way Ray's used to. So what do you say? We then get a montage of Ray and Novak pitching investors to buy land, creating a company called Franchise Realty Corporation. The movie actually undersells how big this was. This is still the model used by companies today. Buy the land, lease it to the franchisee. This changed everything about the American economy. McDonald's brothers argue that he has made a change to their agreement. Ray says he just created a whole new company and the brothers have no authority outside the door. Next, Ray approves the Smith's powdered milkshake idea without permission from the brothers, and we see Ray's wife alone in a large bed shortly before seeing him on a late-night phone call with Velma, who he clearly has the hots for. After the Velma call, he climbs into his bed, and we see that his wife is still awake. Ray sends instant milkshake mix to all the franchises, and when confronted by Dick, declares he is done taking marching orders. Somehow, Ray's wife is still with him, and we get an awkward, quiet dinner between them. It's not fun. He asks for a divorce. She is shocked because she's a decent human being, but he seems set. Ray explains to his lawyer he will never give her part of his business. He tells another lawyer to make it go away regarding separating his wealth from the McDonald brothers. Then we get a scene where Mac grabs the phone and tells Ray off, and I'm glad we get this scene. It's cathartic, though he is eventually owned by Ray because Ray is ruthless. Mac threatens to sue, and Ray correctly tells him, you would probably win, but you can't afford to sue me. And Mac collapses and is hospitalized and told his kidney is near the end. Ray visits him in the hospital. The brothers are on edge instantly. Ray offers Mac a blank check, a literal blank check, not the movie with a 9% Rotten Tomatoes score. The brothers comment, we will never beat him and we will never be rid of him. Eventually, Dick calls Ray with a buyout offer. Ray is incensed at the offer, but BJ Novak plays sane advisor and talks Ray into the deal, but without the 1% perpetuity clause, which seems like it will break them financially, and yet they still agree because they just want to be rid of this man. We end with a scene in the men's room as Dick finally confronts Ray, asking why he didn't just steal their concept and give it his own name. Ray claims the name McDonald really sells the concept and compares it to a franchise named Kroc. McDonald's, the name, sold itself, he suggests, and as soon as he saw it, I knew right then and there I had to have it. The brothers are allowed to keep their restaurant, but are forced to change the name from McDonald's to something else so they don't infringe on the copyright that Ray now owns. The movie ends as it began, with Ray selling the audience, only this time, instead of a multi-mixer, he's selling us a multi-million-dollar company. And we see that he's actually practicing a speech in the mirror to give at an event where the president is apparently going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see him
Governor Reagan.
Governor. And yeah. Then we see him planning to open a McDonald's right in San Bernardino across the street. What a fucking dick.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end, we see he has stolen Velma from Night Owl. He deludes himself in the mirror one more time and then walks off into a blurry background, and we end with real footage of Ray Kroc waxing poetic about McDonald's and I hate him. That is the end of my summary. Aaron and Chris, what did you think of The Founder?
I was surprised. This is my first viewing of The Founder. I was surprised that that I liked it, because when it came out, it felt like it was getting mixed reviews. I don't know if that's true or not. It just was my memory of this was that it was like, it's okay or whatever. And I think he's coming off Birdman when he does this. Michael Keaton does this. But this movie's done by one of these directors that does these kind of like all American movies, John Lee Hancock.
Yeah.
It was funny. I was sitting there. I don't know why it came to mind. I don't know if it was Laura Dern or what, but A Perfect World came to mind in this movie.
Wow.
And he wrote that. He wrote A Perfect World.
He sure did.
Like sitting there going, I don't know. It just entered my head. I wasn't thinking of any connections whatsoever. It just entered it.
It's so amazing.
That's one of the things that I thought of during this. I think Michael Keaton probably still is underrated as an actor. He's been around now for 40 plus, almost 50 years at this point. And he had this great career in the 80s, and it culminated in Batman. And then I think because he didn't want to do Batman past Batman Returns, there was this sort of like pall on him. Like he had to make several comebacks in his life. And I feel like the not going back to Batman was one of them. He may have been also considered like one of those, you know, tough to get along with guys on set or something like that. But I remember seeing him in Jackie Brown in the 90s, and I was just like, my God, man, there's the Michael Keaton that I love right there. And then it seemed like it took forever for him to make that real comeback vehicle and everything. And I don't remember if it was Birdman or if it was a Spider-Man, but I think it was Birdman that really got him back in to the limelight. And I was like, yeah, there's a reason why we love Michael Keaton. And he's good in this, and he's so good in this that you may forget that Ray Kroc's not a guy you want to really like, unless you're just a ruthless asshole. you don't want to like model your life after or anything. But I tell you, this is one of those weird things though for me, because it's yes, McDonald's, he stole their whole thing, but they would never have become as big without him. You have to sit there and check your morals at the door or whatever to say this is a positive thing or whatever, and say like, you know, because the McDonald's brothers were definitely not going to turn this into as a huge of a thing as
they
he
didn't
did.
Have his ambition. I think the movie is, I mean, I'm not trying to interrupt your take. I think the movie is trying to show him as a complicated guy, a guy that has positive qualities that made the success possible, but also has negative qualities that made the success possible.
Yeah. And you know, maybe, and I know I can understand the McDonald's brothers position. He signed a contract. He basically went through the contract and was like, yep, that's okay. Yep, that's okay. He just kept flipping the, he doesn't even have a lawyer with him, which is the biggest problem. And you know, when he goes and asks for more, they're like, no, you know, but I understand that. But at the same time, if they could have just ceded just a little bit of that, I know that's what people go through in Shark Tank all the time. When they go in, they're like, I'm giving you 5% of my company for $1 million. And they're like, you know, and then they're like, you're evaluating your company at $20 million, sir. And he's like, yes, I know. aside from the heinousness of it, I really do appreciate the sort of vision he has in that. I just wish he could have done that vision another way.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where his ambition gets way ahead of what, you know, his morals and ethics and everything. So, I love, you brought up several scenes. I love the scene where he goes up to the counter and he goes, no, that's not possible. I just ordered. and the, that McDonald's employee, which reminds me of today's Chick-fil-A employees, by
yes.
the way. Those guys are always like that. I love the little simulation in the tennis court where he keeps where he keeps changing all the things around to make it perfect, and he gets all those guys out there to like practice it, which is something like that's got to be the most tedious thing in the world, practicing doing fast food and everything, and he's got that all written down on the tennis court. Love that. I love Nick Offerman. I think they pretty much. They wanted a Ron Swanson without the mustache in this, because he's still got the same line readings as he does in Parks and Recreation. You know, he's like, they call it a milkshake because they put milk in it. You know, that type of thing. But I love him in it as well. I mean, this whole cast, that's why I generally don't like it when they cast somebody like Laura Dern as the neglected wife, because I think that they have more to offer in a movie than that. And so I feel like not that this part is there are no small parts and all that, but it just feels like you should get somebody who's, I don't know, lesser stature to play his wife in this than Laura Dern, if she's just going to be the one that's just kind of like getting crapped on the whole movie and everything. Yeah. So, of course I love Laura Dern in this. Linda Cardellini is interesting. I kept thinking of her Mad Men appearance because of course she's one of the many Don Draper conquests in Mad Men. So I just kept thinking of that during the whole thing. But yeah, all in all, I think a lot of the stuff in here that I've never thought about as far as business is concerned. That whole thing with BJ Novak talking about it being a real estate thing, I don't think I'd ever thought of it that way. And of course he had never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But that's, you get that instant stream of cash every single time someone buys a franchise. And of course the franchise makes their money and it's great because it's selling like gangbusters and everything. And you know, I guess they're more than happy to pay the rent, you know, and as long as they can.
This is also, you know, by the way, as an aside, sorry to interrupt, how modern chains like Red Lobster are dying because they were bought by private equity firms who then bought the land and made Red Lobster restaurants that they owned pay them rent on the land and kept driving up the rent, and now Red Lobster's collapsing. So, yeah.
And you would have thought with that Beyonce endorsement, they would have just gone sky high. I really like this. I think that just all those different aspects of business that I'd never thought of before, and they have to, you know, a lot of the stuff that we take for granted is like, you know, just like, you know, him getting the food so fast and all of that. Something that they had to kind of, you know, whoa, that's amazing. That's revolutionary, even though it's not today. Back then, mind blowing.
It's subtle in this movie, but they even like did away with real plates and silverware because they didn't have to deal with plates getting broken earlier when he gets like fried chicken instead of whatever he ordered. It's on like a ceramic plate. Crazy.
Yeah. One other thing on this, I have the Blu-ray on this movie, so I watched the some of the bonus material on it, and they built that McDonald's with the arches on it. They built that for the movie. The set designer did. And I think they also built I think they took an existing building to build that original McDonald's that the brothers start and they created that around it, but they could have created that too. They could have built that too. I wasn't quite. They were a little confusing during the production notes. But that was a cool thing. They had to like build that an actual restaurant that could actually make the stuff that they were making and did all the stuff that they said was happening in it. So I thought that was a really cool touch.
That's neat.
Anyway,
yeah. This is at least my third. I think it might be my fourth time watching this movie because I love this movie. I love a category of filmmaking that I like to call competence porn. The idea of just watching people who are great at something be great at something, and the McDonald's brothers stuff in this movie is crack cocaine. Like, yeah. It is, you've already both mentioned it, they're the best scenes in the movie, the scene when they're telling their story, and just moments where he's like, we realize that 87% of our sales were from three items, and so we went, let's just sell those three items. Genius, yeah. Right? And then the tennis court scene and, like, all that stuff is just, I absolutely love it. So a movie like this, or The Martian's another great example of this, a great competence porn movie, you know, where people are just great at, you know, at problem solving and figuring stuff out, I'm always going to love. You add to that the Keaton performance, which I just think is phenomenal in here, and I'm just going to have a good time. I will say the only thing about this movie that slows it down for me is the Jones stuff. And I know what the movie's doing. I think you even mentioned it in your synopsis. The movie is comparing his taking that man's wife, yes, to him taking the restaurant from the McDonald's brothers. I just don't know that we get enough for that metaphorical comparison to really sink in, to really work. And yet we get enough that the movie slows down for it, right? There's some Joan Ray scenes that it just stalls the movie for me, and it might just be in comparison to the other stuff. Like, the other stuff is so high that stuff you know, kind of takes me out of it for a second, but it's just for a second, and then it's back to, you know, some of the amazing stuff. I think Chris, you touched on this when you were talking about it, love the nuance of the Ray Kroc character in this, in that we know he's quote unquote a bad guy. Like, he is, you know, not treating other human beings well, right? Like, and that at its very core makes him unlikable. And yet the movie is at least having an awareness of the impact he had on the business, you know, that it was, they were never going to be, they tried to franchise it, they didn't know how to do it. And I kind of wish the movie had a little more of a point of view on it, but it has enough of a point of view on the greed is good mentality, Wall Street mentality, you know, kind of thing, where ambition is the ethos, is the ethical, the morals come from making more money, not from how you treat human beings, because we have to wrestle with the fact that that works. And I think that's what this movie does. It says that works. Is it unfortunate that that works? Yeah, kind of is, but it's built into our understanding of economics and capitalism, right? So it's built into the system we live under that can be rewarded or that works. And I, you know, the movie isn't being overly philosophical about it. It just, it's there, and it's allowed to be, have that nuance to it that I really, really appreciate. Other than that, yeah, it's just a really fun watch. It's really well written. You mentioned A Perfect World, another one of my favorite movies. It feels similarly written. I think it's amazing that you had that thought before realizing that. But yeah, I had a great time watching it again. And it's a good one.
I love them. People love fried chicken, right? Well, let them go somewhere that sells fried chicken.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned Chick-fil-A as well, and they kind of took the McDonald's brothers thing and actually did it. You know, like, they didn't overexpand. They did it very slowly. Like, it, they kept all their ingredients. You know, like, it's almost like if McDonald's brothers, That might have happened for them over time. You don't know, but it's interesting.
My old boss at the web design firm I worked at used to use McDonald's as like a business lesson, and I kept thinking about that watching this movie, because he used to say, you can go to any McDonald's in this country and ask for a cheeseburger, and it's going to be the exact same product. Like, that, it's a process. And so he was trying to get the web design team to create a process that would spit out websites the way McDonald's spits out cheeseburgers, which was never going to happen because it was a creative process. But I always appreciated that analogy. I always thought, and you know, here in this movie, the original creators of McDonald's could not get that process to work at all their franchises, but Ray Kroc could, probably because he's the kind of guy, asshole enough, to storm onto a golf course and curse you out for selling fried chicken.
Right.
But by the way, I love that scene in the bathroom where he says it's the McDonald's name that was the carryover and everything. The question is, do I believe that? I think it's a great scene. I don't know. Like, why wouldn't you then try to come up with a name, like brainstorm a name that would work? It's not just McDonald's that's going to work on all this. Obviously, Wendy's ended up working and Hardee's ended up working and all sorts of different little places that you've seen all over the place ended up working. So, like, you know, the idea is that people got the tour like he did. They would have copied all the stuff that they saw back there and made their own restaurant like they did. But they even see that, you know, making other McDonald's in other places didn't work. It's called McDonald's in the other places and they didn't work. So I was sitting there during the whole movie, actually. I'm glad they addressed this because I was sitting there going, why didn't Ray just go ahead and just make his own restaurant with all the stuff he knows and just not call it McDonald's this whole time? That's what their answer is in the end is, oh, well, McDonald's, the name, is what people go for. And I'm like, I don't know if that's the case.
I agree 100%. I don't think that is the case. I think the movie is making a statement there about the idea of people want to be involved in something that feels family values, Midwestern, you know, whatever. Like, there's something like people have a subconscious inherent goodness towards those kind of things. This is the point the movie's making. But McDonald's succeeded because it saw an inefficiency in the market and absolutely capitalized on it and absolutely changed the way food is delivered to people forever. And in fact, there are restaurants now that are doing what McDonald's did then, because McDonald's doesn't do what McDonald's did then anymore. They have a giant menu. They have, you know, so like Five Guys is kind of doing what McDonald's did then, just, you know, serving big, you know, burgers and fries and doing it well.
Sometimes when I go to Five Guys, I'm sad that they don't ever have new items.
Well, there you go. And that is the trauma of our age, you know?
People like fried chicken. Why can't they serve fried chicken?
Why not? Why not?
At Five Guys Burgers and Fries.
Right, exactly. All right. Let's go on to our super secret double feature.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Aaron, what do you think?
I had something I thought of that I won't mention because Jeremy, or you haven't gone yet. So I'm just going to go ahead and say I ended up going with Air, a recent film that kind of feels like the tonal inverse of this movie in some ways. In other words, it's about stealing Michael Jordan's name, except for they don't get away with it, right? Like, you know, they take a stand and now, you know, Jordan makes billions of dollars a year from this deal he made with Nike all these years ago. But it feels like that Damon character feels very much, like a person who has to, you know, figure out how to make this sale, how to get this to happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seemed like a good double feature for me.
Air.
Yeah, I agree.
I loved Air, but I just thought it didn't stay with me. Because it's kind of like cotton candy, I think. But I really liked it. I need to watch it again.
It's really fun. It's a good rewatch. It's definitely a rewatchable movie. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I saw a couple in the chat. One of them that I saw in the chat that this isn't my choice, but The Social Network is definitely a perfectly good one to go with this. I think in tone, though, it's much darker than The Founder, even though The Founder is like its darkness is underneath all the sunniness, and The Social Network, it's just there. And then I saw one in the chat said There Will Be Blood, which would be a really good one. Like, talk another one that's where the darkness is always there, though. It's like the tone of that movie is constantly. Go ahead.
Did you see Slab's line after they mentioned There Will Be Blood?
No.
He said, "I drink your powdered milkshake."
There you go. Perfect. Perfect synergy on that one for sure. But I ended up on another movie that's like this, has the same kind of tone to it, and it's Flash of Genius, the Greg movie where he invents the windshield wiper, windshield wiper. Because that one has all the sort of the same kind of beats to it. And in this case, our main character really is the likable hero. It's kind of a good contrast to this one where you're like, oh, I don't know if I like this guy or not. But... you know, Greg Kinnear has got this intermittent windshield wiper that he shows to all these car companies, does everything he can to protect his invention, but then it gets stolen anyway because, you know, they've got these people who are just, you know, just ready to figure out something just from the smallest things. So that's the movie that I thought of on this, and I think it would go along well with it. There's a lot of these.
Yeah,
we started a business and then somebody comes in and usurps that business type of movie out there.
Yeah, it really is. Pair this with Joy. I don't know what was up my ass about the windshield wiper movie. I watched that. I must have been in a foul mood because everybody seems to love that and I didn't enjoy it. I need to go back to that.
I think you would like it today. It seems as Jeremy a movie as there is. So
yeah.
I must have been off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
must have been.
There was one thing I did mean to mention that I'll just throw in here about the true story nature, because we didn't talk about the 1% deal at the end that they handshake on and that they don't get. And I'd like to study this more because some of the stuff I'm reading says that actually never happened and certainly never happened in a meeting where lawyers were present, you know, that they shook on a 1%. And that it might have been made up by, like, descendants of the McDonald's who are like, we'd be billionaires. So, like, you can see that kind of thing starting by somebody. Can you imagine if they had just asked for 1% in perpetuity, how rich we would be right now?
That's my main thing with all these, because I think this story was written because they sought out the ancestors or the descendants of the McDonald's and that was the story that they got back and everybody's got sort of a, you know, the bias when they tell a story. So, I don't know what to believe on that either. I would have certainly not have shaken his hand on that at all. Because I'll give you the 1%. You're just going to have to trust me on that. No, nobody is going to do that.
Yeah. The movie uses it as a closing whammy, you know, kind of thing, and it may or may not have happened. So,
right. By the way, one other thing that happened earlier on in the chat, there were a lot of people out there who were getting John Carroll Lynch confused with David Koechner. I get John Carroll Lynch confused with Pruitt Taylor Vince, and the reason it's the three name thing, and they play similar characters, and I think Pruitt Taylor Vince tends to play like darker characters than he does. But like when Cherby said the Zodiac Killer, I was like, no, is that was Pruitt Taylor Vince, right? No, it's John Carroll Lynch. And so that's the thing. I don't think they look a lot alike. I just think they have a lot of similar like roles and everything, and they had those three name things going on. Anyway, Aaron, it's your turn to pick for next week. What are we going to watch?
We're going to have a Michael Keaton theme going for a couple weeks. I would like very much to rewatch and discuss Spotlight. I have had this on my rewatch list for a while now and just haven't gotten back to it. And I remember being blown away by this movie, but I have still
Does
only
that mean
seen
you
it the
only
one
saw
time.
It the once?
I have only seen it the one time.
Oh,
so,
Aaron.
I know. Aaron. I know. And thus I chose it.
This movie
very
is
good
great.
Choice.
Yeah.
This very movie is choice. Great. So, I am definitely looking forward to revisiting this as well. This is awesome. Okay, looks like we have time for some questions.
Question. I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Who's an actor that just feels so out of place in a movie?
All right, I'll go first. An actor that feels out of place for me is Gal Gadot in Death in the Nile. I think everybody else in that movie is just in a different headspace and place than she is in that movie. So it really hurts the movie, in my opinion. So yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind for me.
I can totally see that, and I agree with you 100% on that. It's funny, when asking this question, you can see what I had just watched, but so I had just seen The Circle, and I thought Emma Watson was really, really miscast in that movie. She's supposed to be like this, this person who's like seems like a real risk taker. And so that when she does the risk-taking stuff later on in the movie, like that's supposed to pay off. But she never feels like that the entire thing. She feels like post-Hermione, character in this. And she never seems like the character that she's playing in The Circle. But there's a couple of others. I remember seeing Adam Driver in The Force Awakens, and I laughed my ass off when they first showed his face. Because I had been watching the show Girls. That's the first time I saw Adam Driver. And he's such a specific and weird character in Girls that seeing him in Force Awakens threw me off, man. It was just like, I can't take this seriously. Now, by the end of the series, I took him more seriously because I'd seen him in more stuff by that point. But that was a crazy thing. And one other thing was Nick Kroll in Loving, playing the lawyer because I had seen a bunch of Nick Kroll just being, a crazy comedian guy. And to be in a straight up drama, a serious drama like Loving, I saw him in the trailer and bust out laughing because it's Nick Kroll. You know, it's that Family Guy joke where, where they're watching Philadelphia, and it's like, oh my God, Tom Hanks. I laugh at anything he's in. He's such a laugh riot, and it's like. He laughs at it. I have AIDS, and the guy's like, ha 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 ha. So anyway.
Oh man. Well, I had written down for my answer that it wasn't a movie, but when I saw Ed Sheeran on Game of Thrones, it completely killed all suspension of disbelief for me.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
And your answers are so much better than that, but yeah, he's not an actor. I mean, it's just a cameo, but he has lines, and I didn't like it at all. so that's my answer. I'll do better next time.
That's okay. I think that totally fits. On the chat, Nolan says Nicole Kidman in The Northman. I've only seen The Northman once. I can't remember her in that movie, actually. I know she's in it, but that probably speaks to what you're talking about because I can't even remember her in the movie. Josh says every single actor in movie 43. Absolutely. Nolan says Bradley Cooper in Nightmare Alley is also a terrible performance. I don't know if I agree with that, but, I can see you seeing that. Castro says every single actor in Megalopolis. Yeah. Megalopolis, man. That movie deserves to be dissected in a crazy way someday.
You heard it here. Chris's next big recommend, Megalopolis.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's right. Correct. Spoiler alert. Castro, Jason Momoa in Fast X. He's the best thing about Fast X, though. That's the thing. To me, I thought he was. He's out of place, but he's the best part of it. Yeah. Josh says, Paul Reiser and Alien. So, yeah, I agree. It's a stand-up comic, especially at the time, a stand-up comic going in and doing a sci-fi action movie. Didn't seem right. James says, Tom Hanks is Walt Disney in Saving Mr. Banks. He says, John Lee Hancock again. Perfectly fine, but Disney and Hanks are two different personas, and I never forgot I was watching Hanks. That kind of happens every time he tries to play somebody different, even like in The Lady Killers and Elvis. That's the other one. Even though when he's affecting an accent of some sort, it's still Tom Hanks every single time. And it's a good thing that Tom Hanks is very likable, because he can get away with that. Shaggy says, Bob Odenkirk and nobody. Yes, that's a good one. Thinking of Bob Odenkirk as a badass is kind of funny. Queen Latifah in Sphere. And she died. This is what Lang said.
Poor Queen Latifah.
Josh says Harvey Keitel in The Piano as a romantic lead also seems weird. I would agree with that as well.
Yep.
I guess we got time for one more. Let's see. We now have a name for the Brad Pitt led Formula One movie coming out next year. It's just going to be called F1. What are your favorite movies with simple to the point titles?
Boy, I am excited about this movie because it's Joseph Kosinski and he's doing some new camera stuff. Mm-hmm. And they've spent like 2.5 years shooting it at various F1 races. I don't really care about F1, but everyone else in my life around me does. My answer to this question is X, the first of the trilogy, X, Pearl, and Maxine. It's very simple. It conveys basically everything you need to know about the movie. Yep. And I love that movie. So there you go. Mm-hmm.
I think Signs is a perfect movie title. It is one of those titles that it reveals itself a little bit, yet it's just one word. You think of Signs and Wonders, the idea of like, you know, signs of the aliens. And at the end of the day, it's really about the idea of the signs that are around us all the time. I really love Signs. I'm going to throw in an honorable mention to Rope as well, which I think is a great movie title. And it also reveals itself as the movie goes on. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Nice. Mine's Adaptation. I think it also has, it's a very simple one that has lots of meanings, especially when you watch the movie. And see all the different ways they take adaptation. I love that title. Over in the chat, Slab says Spotlight. Josh says John Wick. Nolan says The Who killed Hitler and then Bigfoot, which is a Sam Elliott movie that I've never seen. Shaggy and Link both say Up. Josh jokes Debbie Does Dallas, but you know what? It says so much, doesn't it?
It does.
Castro says Interstellar. And then how about Moneyball? That title is so ubiquitous, baseball front offices now. Yeah, for sure. Davidel says Hook. Castro says Arrival. Yeah, all of those are really good choices. All right. Yep. That's going to do it for this week. Spotlight will be our homework for next week. Looking forward to talking about that again. That'll be great. Once again, chat, thanks for coming out and listening to us again. So fantastic of you to come out here and witness this greatness that's before you.
Witness me.
Exactly. Witness me. Yes. I'm so glad that you guys have the Krylon ready to do that. That's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. Thank you.
have one of those days where you're not 100% sure you're not still dreaming and like something weird might happen at any minute? This feels like one of those days. Like I keep expecting like a duck to walk by or I don't know, something.
Those are some really weird days.
I'm not sure I woke all the way up.
I love that your foundational dream state is duck transportation. That's Jeremy's dream space is how do mallards take a walk?
One dream I had was that teeth had started growing out of the roof of my mouth. And I was out of bed in the bathroom with a flashlight looking in my mouth in the bathroom before I realized, oh, that was a dream. That's not real.
What's hilarious is I was literally thinking about like something I could talk about during outtakes, and it was the fact that last night I woke up several times with something tickling my nose. Like I couldn't, you know, get it out. It was just like tickling, like not just like the front of the nose, but like inside the navel cavity, like back towards, you know, the brain or whatever. And I'm just like, it's probably just a dog hair or something like that. And then my brain was like, but what if it's a spider? You know, what if a spider in the middle of the night crawled in your nostril and it's in there? And my personality type is such that I went, shut up, brain, and I went back to sleep. So I'm very thankful that I can tell my brain to shut up like that. But that is definitely not true for everybody.
I'm glad that Aaron decided to use the word mallard because we are going to discuss the founder, which has John Carroll Lynch, who was in Fargo, who made a stamp. If you recall the movie Fargo, created the picture for a stamp for a mallard that would go on a stamp, and it's at the very end of it. You know, this is they announced it, and he's and she's like, "You're mallard," and he's like, "Yep, it's just a 3 cent though."
I'll tell you one thing I'm experiencing right now, too, is with holiday gift buying for my kids and stuff, is that thing that happens every year, which is like, oh, I should get this for this son. Also, I want one. And so, like, everything I get for them now, because they're older, I'm like, and one for me. Thank you very much. But now I can't, like, for, like... These walls are a little thin, so I'll whisper. But like, I got a Detroit Lions hoodie for one of my sons, and now I can't use mine until like I already have it, but it's, you know, going to remain unused until after Christmas.
Yeah, that's too bad. That's a shame.
My trauma, guys. My pain.
Did they send you a screener for Wicked? Is that how come you keep watching it? Or did you just keep going to the theater?
Okay. No. This year's been really nice. The Critics' Choice, for the first time, and this has been a long time coming, has a dedicated screeners app. So now the studios can just put the files in a dedicated screener app for us. So like I actually had to pull out. Okay. So a few years ago, one of the studios sent me an Apple TV, like a little puck, you know, one of the little Apple TV pucks.
Okay.
But because, you know, Hollywood, you know, visual companies, like they're Apple, like they only have an Apple app for this thing. So I had to pull that out of storage somewhere so that I could use this app to watch these screeners. But it's fine. I just, you know, plugged it into my TV, and now I have pretty much everything is there, which I've been really impressed by the fact that they were able to do that. The only thing I can think of that's not there is Mufasa, but I don't think they're really making a push for Mufasa in any categories. So it's not like, you know, that we needed to see that early for any kind of particular reason. So, yeah.
So they haven't given you Mufasa?
No, that's the only one that I can think of like that's a big deal. There's some minor ones.
I don't want
that
movie to exist, but I want to watch it because Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the music. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, that's evil that they did that.
I have a feeling it's going to be good, unfortunately. Well, it's better than Moana 2, I'll tell you that. That was I think Hollywood is going to learn some terrible lessons from Moana 2, the way that it's blowing. Or are they going to learn the right lessons, maybe? And maybe the right lessons are terrible, which is that, you know, quality doesn't actually matter. All that matters is nostalgia. And, like, you know, they released a direct-to-video sequel to theaters, and it made bank. You know what I mean? So Iger was right.
They never, ever get the right lessons from anything.
Yeah.
It's always the external that they see on these things. It's like, oh, The Sixth Sense did well in August, so we'll come out with our weird horror movie in August as well. and or it'll be like, you know what people really loved about Star Wars? They loved, like, you know, they loved all those ship battles, so let's put nothing but ship battles in our sci-fi movie. And so, like, you just people forget that there's a building process. It's just like a house. There's a foundation and everything on what a movie is and what made us care about the movie, what made us care about those ship battles and stuff like that. But, you know, they always look at those external things. See, right there, the lightsabers, man. It's the lightsabers. I went to a friend's house over the weekend, and what he set up, he had the non-special edition Star Wars. I don't think I'd seen that Star Wars version in forever. I've got the tapes, but I don't have a VCR these days. But man, watching that original Star Wars without all the junk that George Lucas threw into it and everything, so much better. I don't know. I've turned myself around and around on this George Lucas, whether he has the right to change his old movies and all that. I think that's silly. I think, yes, you can, but, you know, you do that at your own peril, I think, and you do it to, you know, you risk the movie that you made and everything. But, like, I think even if, and I don't like any of the editions of the special edition. I don't like anything that he did with that. But I think that even if those were improvements, I wouldn't want them to be in there, because watching the movie in its 1977 state without something encroaching upon it was so much of a better experience overall. It's 'cause that was his movie at that time, and that's way it's going to, you know, it's the way it's always going to be. You don't get your take backs and everything. Unlike, you know, it was what kind of Mark Borchardt was saying, if I had this set of circumstances, we would have put this up on the screen and everything. And it's like, he got, you know, George Lucas has enough money to do that type of thing. But man, just one thing, the thing that always gets me, this is good in the special edition and the, you know, the original, but The one of my favorite all-time scenes, and I've never, like, went and deconstructed it, but it's a great, combination of score and editing and everything, is when Obi-Wan sacrifices himself in that scene. The music swells up. There's this big gun battle that starts, and the music is incredible during the scene. But the scene, but that one little cut to Darth Vader going over and kicking the robe just gets me every time. It's so good, and you don't ever see stuff like that anymore, and it's why people are always like, God, I wish movies could be like that again. Anyway,
I was just gonna say, it's Star Wars reissue A New Hope. That was the first movie I ever built in a projection booth. And the guy who had trained me, and all he had done to this point was build one or two in front of me, said, don't fuck it up, and then walked away.
Save big this holiday season. All in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Then get a flavorful Kroger spiral sliced ham for 89 cents a pound with an additional $25 purchase. Limit two, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.